Hi guys, and welcome to A Glass for Every Palette. I can't believe we are at the end of the year already. This is crazy. Listen, I know that there's a lot of push to crush all these goals and pivot, but if you have survived 2020 and you've made it to this point, it's a win. Give yourself some credit. Our last guest for the year is someone that, my goodness, this woman's accomplishments are unparalleled. And on top of that, you know, when you actually like meet someone, whether it's virtually or in person, and you just click and it just works and you just are like in love with them. That's what's happened this week. Guys, our last guest of 2020 is my fellow SOM TV castmate personality, Jill Zamorski. Hi, Jill.
Hey, Shakira. Oh, what a lovely intro. That was very kind of you. I've got a huge smile on my face.
Oh my God, I can hear it. I'm so happy to have you.
I am so happy to be here.
We have become such fast friends. We end up talking for hours after we finish recording. Jill is an amazing breath of fresh air. She has such an extensive amount of knowledge. She is a wine educator. She has such an incredible voice and panache, that's the word I'm going to use, for explaining wine and breaking things down to people. We are thrilled to have her. Hi, Jill. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling good. It's the end of a day. It's the end of the year. It's just, you know, trucking, just moving along.
Girl, same. What a week this has been. For you guys that don't know, my full-time career is actually in tech. And this week is the first week that my hospital in New York City was able to start administering the vaccine. So it has been a long, long, long week. All right, Jill. So here at A Glass for Every Palette, we are very much interested in not only recapping your journey, but understanding like your perspective on your philosophy of wine. So let's begin at the beginning. What is it that got Jill Zamorski into wine in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. I guess two different things. The thing that first got me into the hospitality industry wasn't necessarily the thing that got me into wine, but it was the thing that certainly allowed me to taste the first really nice wines I'd ever tasted. So when I was in college, I had a part-time job that I kind of landed it in a very random way. Long story short, I was really lucky. My parents paid for college and for my, you know, tuition, room, and board. And I didn't remember the details of the story, but my dad reminded me when we were talking relatively recently that apparently I came home after either a break or after my first year in college and announced to my mom and dad that we, my group of friends and I, were going to, I don't know, like go to Jamaica or something for spring break. And my dad was like, "That's nice. Who's paying for that?" And I was like, "Well, you and mom." And he was like, "Think again, kiddo." And I said, "Well, that's part of the college experience." And I think he actually kept a straight face when I explained full of myself that it was clearly part of the college experience that I expected my parents to pay for me to go drink on spring break in the Caribbean. And he laughed and said, in fact, that was not part of something he and my mom felt they should pay for. And he suggested I get a job. And I had played competitive sports all through high school, so I didn't actually have any sort of job experience. So I contacted a temporary agency, and I ended up getting a position at this very fancy, very old school boutique hotel, and like the kind of place where the chefs are all French and the servers are all English or German, and the waiters wear tuxedos, and all of the women wear like the old school like black dress with the white collar, cuffs, and apron.
Oh, dear, I mean, it was the like kidney heels?
It was like picture perfect. And so I was this college kid, and for a while, all I did was polish things. So I polished all the silver and the plates and the glasses. And one of the things that, even though I didn't even go into the dining room, I didn't interact with any guests, I did get to attend wine classes and pre-shifts. And so I heard about wine, and I certainly got to taste new and exciting and different types of food that I'd never tasted before. So that was a really eye-opening experience for me. And I really liked the job. And so I ended up keeping it part-time all through college. So it was, wow, you know, a way to earn money, but it was also very formative for me. So my very first experience in the world of hospitality was at a very high level in terms of fine dining. And I just liked it. I liked the routine, and I liked the ceremony of it all. It was really fun. And then my plan, you know, following graduation was never to work in the hospitality industry. My plan was actually to go to law school. And I worked for a law firm for a while after college. And then I, you know, traveled. I rode my bicycle across the country, and I spent all the money I had saved up, and I decided I didn't want to go back to school. What do you do then when you have no place to live, no money? You move in with a college roommate and you find a job with the only skills you have, which I worked in a small French restaurant. And so I had had experience in a restaurant. So I was at this point working as a server, and I did not realize that I actually had a pretty decent amount of food and wine knowledge. And so I kind of progressed up through the ranks, and eventually I relocated to Washington, D.C. and was working as a manager in a restaurant. And that's where I met the first sommelier I ever met. She's a friend of mine still to this day. Her name's Nadine Brown. And she was the longtime wine director at Charlie Palmer Steak. And getting to know Nadine, we actually took a couple of trips together to wine country. So my first visits to wineries in California that she set up, and got to see kind of the ins and outs of what the job of a sommelier is. And after working with her and at that restaurant for a couple of years, I struck out on my own and applied for my first position as a sommelier, and have never looked back from there. So that was like in 2005, 2006. And so I've been working in the wine industry exclusively ever since.
Wow, Nadine Brown has to now be our next guest. I know her well.
Yes.
I love and adore her.
I didn't know you knew Nadine. Ah, she's the best.
She's freaking amazing. Such a wealth of knowledge. You know, it's always funny to hear the careers that people would have pursued had they not gone into wine. Where, I mean, there's just literally, there's like this case for us to be really good friends. And every time we chat, I collect more evidence proving the case that it's natural that we're good friends. And one of it is that I actually also was very, very hell-bent on a career in law until ..
You know, it's funny. Ever since then, I've always been told by any lawyer I meet who I talk to about wine that they feel, having never met me before and knowing nothing about me, that I've made the right decision. So, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm good with my decision.
It's one of those careers where if you meet the right person at the right time, awesome, you pursue it. If you meet the right person at the wrong time, shit, probably won't work out very well. But nonetheless, we persevere. So, okay, so now you're working in a French restaurant where you have relative exposure to a lot of wines, but still, there are a lot of people that do that, and it's more of a transient role, and they don't really pursue it as a career. So what is it about either wine or hospitality that was that moment for you where, like, you know what? I'm going to do this for real, for real.
Again, I think it was, you know, a couple of things, some maybe silly and some less silly. I've always been a little bit of a night owl. And so that sort of schedule, working late into the evening and not having to, you know, to do the same thing every single day, starting in, you know, early in the morning, kind of a 9 to 5. I really like that kind of schedule. I like how it's never the same thing. I mean, even if you serve the same food and beverages, you're going to be serving them and talking to and interacting with different people all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kept it really fresh. And I mean, I also, I don't know, I met a chef and I fell in love with a chef. And so I thought this was actually, for a while, I thought it would be interesting to like have my own restaurant. I've gotten over that. And I got over that chef too. But, you know, I had a bunch of different ideas that sort of made me think this could be a career. And then I just, honestly, as I got into wine specifically, I realized as I progressed and as I got to know a little bit more, it opened up doors for me. And I love traveling. I miss traveling so much right now. And that's one of the best things about a career in the wine industry that, you know, is sort of a, wasn't the reason I went into it, but it was like the best perk of it all, is that anywhere in the world where grapes are grown to make delicious wine is a pretty nice place to visit. and it can be a great way to see the world. And so that's, you know, traveling and the ability to work kind of anywhere with anyone and the ever-changing aspect of who you meet, those are the things that kept me in it for sure.
Oh, so you, I this is going to be a weird question for you because the places that you've worked, you've had access to like super elevated bottles of wine. But what is the first wine that you can remember going, wow, this is different. This is doing something for me.
Well, I guess at two different points. So the very first wine I remember thinking like, holy cow, was actually at this hotel that I worked at, you know, part-time all through college. And one year for New Year's Eve, I mean, I clearly enjoyed it. I was working there during New Year's Eve as a college student. But the house champagne, I mean, this was like a very fine dining place. I mean, there were no kids allowed. It was prefix only, like, you know, suit and tie requirements. It was pretty, you know, pretty stuffy in some ways.
Pretty posh. Okay.
It was posh. But in one New Year's Eve, I don't remember the year exactly. It was a while I was in college. But the house champagne that was being poured that evening was Perrier Jouet Fleur de Champagne 1990. And that wine is delicious. That's some nice champagne. And I definitely enjoyed more than, you know, my fair share. And that was, you know, that's what we as the staff got to toast with at the end of the night. There was, you know, there was no cheap, mediocre bubbles for us. We were toasting with the nice stuff. And that was certainly not the kind of stuff that I was drinking with my friends in school. So that was the first wine that I really remember thinking like, wow, this is really good. I should make a note of this. And then fast forward a few years later, it kind of started my just affection for all things Spanish and Spanish wine and Spanish cuisine. I was working in a small restaurant in Virginia and I became familiar with the wines of this winemaker named Alejandro Fernandez.
Mm-hmm.
And his like pretty basic wine from Ribera del Duero, it's called Condado de Haza. And like you can find it anywhere. You can find it in the grocery store, but it's just so good. And I really liked it. It was probably the first time I'd ever had, you know, Tempranillo, Tinto Fino, and it was so good. And who would have known that fast forward, you know, a few years in the future, I would get to go to Spain and I would get to meet him and I would get to go to all the wineries and, you know, then I would get to go back to Spain multiple times. So those are two wines that really stand out in my mind as very eye-opening.
Okay, so there are several courses out there that you can pursue. So when you decided that you wanted to make wine a profession and you wanted to pursue, you know, a formal course of study for this, what made you choose a particular program over another and why?
Well, Nadine actually had a lot to do with that. So she was the one who introduced me to the Court of Master Sommeliers. And then through Nadine, I became acquainted with other sommeliers in Chicago, or DC. I live in Chicago now. I was in Washington, DC then. And so that's where I got to meet this crew of sommeliers in DC. And that's how I first thought about pursuing, you know, certification through the Court of Master Sommeliers. So I, in pretty rapid succession, took the introductory exam and then the certified exam.
Mm-hmm.
And I had toyed with the idea of pursuing it further, but then I also became, and I don't remember how I became aware, but I also became aware of the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. And so I, along with my boss at the time, I was working for Jose Andres at this point, we both took the level 3, the advanced course with the WSET in wine and spirits. And so we took that together. And I really liked how these two programs, you know, they're very different and they have different goals and they play to different strengths, but they also kind of complement, you know, like the yin and yang, the black and white cookie kind of thing. And so I did the level 3 with the WSET and then I started my diploma. And then I went and took my advanced exam and passed my advanced exam with the Court of Master Sommeliers. So I kind of zigzagged back and forth because I liked both of them. So I just decided these would both be paths that I would pursue. And it, you know, it was never a linear thing. I did the first two levels with the Court of Master Sommeliers. And then I didn't take my advanced exam until 6 years after I passed my certified because I was busy doing certifications with the WSET. And after I passed my advanced exam, I ended up moving to Colorado and decided I wanted to pursue the master sommelier exam. And so I, you know, took and passed theory. And so I got into the mix, you know, onto the clock of pursuing the MS. And it wasn't until after I passed the MS exam that I was like, oh, you know what? I should finish my diploma. And so I finished my diploma last year, actually. So it's been kind of hopscotching back and forth. But like I said, they're different programs. And I think that they both have, you know, there's good things about both of them.
So there are often questions about which, the court's had its issues now, but I think that people that are considering pursuing studies are often confused about which course to do. And, you know, you have court people that have followed that trajectory and you have WSET people that have followed that one, but you've done both. So you have a really unique perspective. Your experience that gave you kind of a window, not a window, but a front seat view of both of the curriculums, both of the different styles, different things that are tested. What would you say are like the one or two primary differences between the court's curriculum and WSET's curriculum?
There's a fair number of differences, but the biggest, I think the most critical thing, especially for people who are trying to decide which is a better option for them, is that the WSET does not test on service. So it's a very different exam structure, but there is no service exam. And so if you are not in the hospitality industry, if you're not in and obviously the hospitality industry has been gutted right now, so many people are not in restaurants the way that they have been before. But if you've never had experience serving beverages in a hotel, in a restaurant, at a resort, something like that, at a higher level, you don't have to have service experience at the introductory level with the court. But at the certified, at the advanced, certainly at the master's, if you don't have experience with that side of, you know, pairing, of service, of decanting, of opening sparkling wine, of making cocktails and stuff, I don't know that that's the best route, because there's much to know and much to learn and much to practice about the service of beverage alcohol. And if that's not anything you have experience with, it's going to be so much harder, but it also might not be applicable to what you do. So I think that the WSET, if that's not your background, but you still have, you know, interest in pursuing wine certification, I think the WSET makes a lot more sense. Now, conversely, you asked for one reason, I'll give you two. Sorry, overachiever. But the other thing that's really different is that the WSET, especially if you pursue higher levels, it requires writing and research papers and things like that. And that's not something that appeals to everybody. And so, you know, the styles of exams that are given, I guess the general umbrella would be that the styles of exams are very different and they probably play to different strengths for different people. So, you know, research papers and writing, you know, what basically amounts to like a, you know, a dissertation might be your absolute nightmare, or it might be something that you're really down with. Or the idea of service, which is, you know, my favorite part of the MS exam and the exams before it, you know, that was something that was really comfortable for me because that's what I had been doing for years. I actually enjoyed that part of those exams because it was basically doing what I got to do every single night. And trust me, anyone who spent any significant amount of time working in the service industry, like we all have our like hall of horrors in terms of like the nightmares and the horrible situations we've dealt with from like guests and crazy requests and stuff like that. So like that prepared me for those exams, you know, well. So that's the big difference, I think.
So the tasting component is the methodology for blind tasting is extremely different. Which one do you think like prepares you to talk to guests and to make wine and the language of it more approachable and understandable and relatable?
Well, to be honest, I think it's the WSET method, and it's for a couple reasons. With the Court of Master Sommeliers, one of the things we talk about with the purpose for blind tasting is that it allows you to assess a wine on its merits. And so, for example, if you were considering purchasing wine for your program, for a by-the-glass pour or a placement on your list, if you were to taste the wine and not know its provenance, its producer, you could assess for yourself the quality and what you think it's worth. And then you can see, you know, who the producer is and how much it costs. And you can decide if it's worth what you thought or not, how those two things align. And so that's where blind tasting, I think, really comes in to play for working in the hospitality industry. But the W set is very different. One of the things in the exams, you might not even be asked to identify the major grape variety in a wine. Rather, you have to describe the wine, and you might have to comment on a process that the winemaker used that created the final style of wine. And so I think it creates this big picture look at why is this wine the way it is. Now, that said, the ability to talk to somebody about wine in a coherent and non-condescending and helpful manner, neither program necessarily prepares you for that. That might be a little bit more of a personal thing. And I'm certain people who are part of both programs who are excellent and horrible at that. But I think the idea of explaining and understanding the why, and that's behind all of it, and I think this is my biggest thing with blind tasting, is that I have this belief that theory drives everything, that understanding the why and the processes and the cause and effect, I think that that's huge. And when you understand that theory, then it helps you, I think it helps you understand the way the wine is and how it's presenting and sort of the goal for it.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's completely understandable that would be super helpful. So one of the things that makes tasting and, you know, the approach to how we evaluate wines that actually can be modified to be more inclusive is that we expand the language that's used and the descriptors that are used. For instance, mm-hmm. I'm from Central America. If you ask anybody to give you an example of sour, that's from that part of the world or Southeast Asia or any of that, we'd say tamarind, right? That's a great example of something that's sour. If I ask the average American or I use tamarind to describe something, they have no concept of what that is or what it tastes like. And similarly, if you asked me something about a gooseberry 5 years ago, I've never had a gooseberry in my life until that point, nor have I ever intentionally gone out to smell or taste one. So I think that this is one way that we can kind of open up the language used in wines to a more vast amount of people. What do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
I think by asking, talking, and kind of asking people from all over the world with an interest in wine to contribute. I think part of the problem is the verbiage that we use to talk about wine, it's remained largely unchanged. And it's very Eurocentric. I mean, there are terms that the W set still uses that we just never even use in the United States. And that's just a very, very narrow sliver. And so the vocabulary was sort of decided on, you know, generations ago by a very small group of very likely old white men, and it hasn't evolved. And the thing is, the wine industry has evolved. And so we need to first recognize and then realize that the wine industry is bigger and broader than it ever has been. And so to make it as inclusive as it needs to and should be, we need to think about every facet of it, including the words that we use to describe the wines. Because if you think about it, when you're describing a wine to a consumer, a customer, a guest, you don't know what their personal experiences are. So if you only frame a wine in your specific vocabulary, you might not resonate with them as clearly or be able to describe the wine as effectively. So if you have a bigger, broader, more diverse vocabulary, then you're going to be able to more effectively understand and describe wine. I think that's really important, because so much about the world of wine is ensconced in traditions, and traditions are great, but that's not the only thing that's great about wine. You know, wine is inclusive and it brings people together over, you know, shared experiences and things like that. And so I think more people need to, I would love to get a round table of a wine industry, you know, personalities who are involved in different organizations, whether, you know, not just the court and the W set, but just wine aficionados, wine professionals, even some amateurs, you know, just regular consumers or collectors, just get a whole round table together. I imagine like a big Google Doodle or something like that. And, you know, we can talk about certain senses. I mean, if we think about different flavors and different structures, I mean, when we talk about structure in wine, that's something that's, you know, sugar, acid, tannin, alcohol. I mean, those are things that are like, I don't know. I guess there could be other ways to describe wine, but when it comes to flavors, the actual descriptors for aromatic and flavor kind of characteristics of a wine, I mean, that should be almost as limitless as the vocabulary. Now, I don't run the Court of Master Sommeliers and I don't run the W set, so I'm not in charge of choosing any of those wines that might be used in a blind tasting. But by and large, my understanding is that the wines that are chosen are wines that are available commercially you know, with some regularity throughout the world. So a wine that doesn't enjoy sort of any export and is only available in its very small area of production is probably not the best option for a blind tasting, because unless you've been to that very small area of production, it's going to be largely unknown to people in the industry. And so the same, I think, would be true of a descriptor. If it was not something that is, I mean, tamarind, that's known in Latin culture, in Asian culture. I mean, that's to me, that's something that's universal. And so like, that's a great descriptor of something that is tart or sour. And, but if it was like some, you know, maybe obscure fruit that is only found in one location around the world and is not grown ever, maybe that's not the best. And so it's not that there would be millions of descriptors, but if we sort of think about the idea that to blind someone on a wine, regardless of whatever sort of approach you're taking, it has to be a wine that if you're in South Africa, if you're in, you know, if you're in Italy, if you're in Japan, if you're in India, if you're in the United States, like if you could find a wine made from that grape variety, like that's reasonable. Because there's wine professionals in all of those countries and wine enthusiasts in all of those countries.
Even something as simple as like baking spices, like all of these holiday-esque baking things, those are not, like we don't traditionally put those things into any baked good. So even to say something like that, if what you're trying to describe is oak and you just use something like baking spices, well, who bakes with those spices? And spices vary so much across like the culinary footprint of the world. It's weird to use just these three specific things to describe oak in wine.
Well, you know, to your point, those spices for, and I will say like the baking spices, like I know I've said that in a blind tasting, but I do sort of hate that term because it lumps very distinct spices all together in one category. And I've heard, and I'm sure I used to say it, and I've tried really hard to like kind of correct myself and be a little bit more accurate in what I say, but I've definitely heard, you know, other people pair it back to me, like baking spices, cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice, clove. And I'm like, first of all, those four spices are wildly different. Sometimes people throw cardamom in there. And I'm like, okay, if you've never separated those four, you know, four or five things out and smelled and or tasted them distinctly, like they are wildly different. And so a clove and cardamom are super pungent and super delicious, but they are not the same as allspice. And they are not the same as cinnamon or nutmeg, you know, like. So I feel like that's just it's out of habit or laziness or whatever, it's become part of the American wine vernacular and it's not terribly accurate. And so therefore it's not terribly useful or effective.
You know, for me and for the way we make oatmeal or porridge, like when you make that, you add nutmeg, you add cinnamon, you might add allspice. And those are not, those would not be considered baking spices, but they're spices that are regularly used. So whereas for someone, if I'm talking about oak, right, and I just say baking spices, that eliminates making a correlation to a lot of people. But if I just described what I was talking about and used it in a more broad context, it has a broader appeal to other people. You know, and even with food and wine pairings, right? Like we have these very traditional sounding pairings like, oh, baked chicken or roasted chicken. And the spices that you use on those things or to season that chicken is very different, you know, depending on where you're from. And I think the traditional food and wine pairings that we hear and that are taught in curriculums really don't match the global footprint of what people are eating and what they'll subsequently be drinking their wines with. So again, I think there's so much value in broadening the conversation. And I try to do it intentionally. Like, look, this is what I eat. Now I cook and eat a lot of stuff, but we have to broaden the conversation. We have to broaden the vernacular. We need to broaden the examples that we're giving.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's food and wine pairing. I'm really glad you brought that up because it's a very interesting subject. A pairing is just a suggestion. And to that point, like if you as a young wine, you know, lover wanted someone's advice on what to pair with a roast chicken and you just asked like, I don't know, someone at some place in North America, you might get a very predictable response, Pinot Noir or something like that. But if you, you know, it depends on who you ask. And I think part of the problem is we know that, you know, there are classic examples of food and wine pairings that work because they taste delicious together. But I see asked in like online forums, and people ask me frequently, and I'm sure people ask you, like, what should I pair with this? And my response is 100%, whether it's out loud or in my head, well, have you tried? Like, what have you actually tried? Because it's one thing to say that there are these classic pairings, or, you know, roast chicken goes well with this. But if your recipe of roast chicken has other, you know, other flavors and accoutrement and seasoning, well, what have you tried to pair with it? But maybe don't rely so heavily on just someone else's recommendation of what a good pairing is. I wish more people would just, and I know it's expensive. I realize to open a bottle of wine and to taste it with food, I realize that's not something that I recognize that's not something everybody has the ability to do. But for years, I've seen people posting on online forums like, hey, here's this dish in my restaurant. Like, what should I pair with it? I'm like, I don't know. Like, what's in your cellar? Pop a bottle, taste some stuff, see what you think. Because some of the most exciting pairings out there are the unexpected pairings. You're like, wow, I never in a million years would have put those two things together. But man, that's some synergy in my palate, you know? And so the only way you figure that out is through experimentation. And that's the most fun part, right?
Oh, absolutely. Those are the best ones. And especially if right now everyone is at home, they're having snacks, they're having lots of stuff. Those unconventional pairings are the best.
I guess I would, on that subject of food and wine pairings and how there's so much difference in, you know, the global cuisine and global wine vocabulary, is that also make some decisions for yourself. Further, if you are the person who is responsible for making, you know, the wine decisions or making the pairing recommendations in your restaurant, like, harness your power for good. Like, if you find something that's complementary, even if it's not, you know, if it goes against like the pervading wisdom or whatever, like, own it, you know, and take some pride in that you can justify this accompaniment for whatever reason you enjoy it.
I have eaten cuisines from all over the world. But one of the things I'm always shocked by is what's considered spicy to other people versus what's considered spicy to me. So in a conventional pairing, you know, it's like, oh, you don't want to pair a wine like, let's say, a really good California Zin that's got a pretty good amount of oak on it with those baking spices with a very, very spicy food. But being from the Caribbean, I feel like, shit, Zin and jerk chicken is one of the best things I've ever had. Yes, it amplifies the spice in the jerk seasoning, but to me, it's in the most beautiful way. So I'm not offended by it. You know, in the Caribbean, for the most part, if you serve fried fish, there's an acidic component to balance it off. So in some countries, it's like something called escovitch, which is like vinegar, sugar, allspice, carrots, and pickled vegetables that are in like a quick pickle served over a well-seasoned fried fish. So I wonder, like, how do we expand the lexicon that we use? How do we introduce more people into using and accepting the same way people from across the diaspora might not be familiar with a gooseberry or things like that? How do we broaden the conversation where maybe a more Eurocentric palate is more open and more used to understanding that there are other flavor profiles across the world that equally and appropriately describe a wine? It's just not terms or taste or flavors that the American palate might be used to.
Well, I think part of it, like, it's funny, you mentioned gooseberry, and I remember I had never heard of what a gooseberry was, but that's a description that's classically associated with Sauvignon Blanc. And then at the farmer's market one day, I saw a little basket full of gooseberries, and I was like, well, shit, I'm going to buy those. And lo and behold, I tasted one, and it tasted just like Sauvignon Blanc. And so I think part of it is you must have an active sense of seeking out taste, like be an active taste hunter, because it's like you mentioned spicy food, and I almost feel like ability to appreciate spiciness is almost like you can like build up a greater appreciation, or you can like your threshold for spiciness can kind of increase or decrease depending on the frequency with which you eat spicy food. At least that was mm-hmm. my personal experience based mm-hmm. on like different restaurants I worked in, and like there were times in my life where I was like, and I'm an adventurous eater, but there are times in my life where I was like, oh yeah, the hotter the better. Give me the like all the chili peppers on the menu sign. Like, that's cool. And then there have been times in my life where I'm like, oh, wow, that seems really, like, that's a bit much for me. Like, it's, I feel like that's going to give me the heartburn. And so I think you, as someone who in the world of wine, I think searching for tastes and tasting different things and then normalizing describing wines in a varied way. And that should come from consumers. That should come from, you know, the retail world. It should come from the on-premise world. It should come from the certification world. And I think, and I hope, I have not given up hope, though there's been a lot of reasons to toy with that idea, that there will be positive change affected in the you know, these antiquated bodies of certification. I think that there's good that comes. Like you and I, like we like the pursuit of knowledge. We want to know more and different things. And there will be different people in charge and writing kind of the new vocabulary. And it'll be a newer and diverse and a broader swath of the population. And those old terms, useful though some may be, will not be the only terms used to describe a wine accurately. Now, you know, anywhere in the world, you're going to probably encounter someone who what you say doesn't resonate with them. And that's just because the world of wine is so personal. But I think we have to advocate for it. We have to be active. Mm-hmm. And we just have to do it. I don't know what else to say. And I think also if encountering any sort of objection or resistance to that has to be met with the advice that an old boss of mine once gave, if someone gives you an answer you don't like, you just sort of smile and say, well, why do you think that is? You know, so if someone says, well, that roast chicken, that's not the roast chicken. Why do you think that is? You know, and like mm-hmm. flip the script and it kind of shines a light on just what a narrow perspective maybe that person unintentionally had. It's not confrontational, but it's just why do you think that
different.
Is?
It's different. It's different, you know, in project management, which is the other world that I live in, and tech and all those things, there's this concept of the five whys, right? Like, that you never actually get to the root of what an inquiry or a question is until you ask why five times. I don't want to go outside. Why? Because it's cold. Why do you feel cold? Well, I don't think my jacket's heavy enough. Why don't you have a jacket that's heavy enough? Well, I'm not from a cold climate where we're used to buying clothes for sub-zero. You know what I mean? So it's this continuous path. And I think that the more that people like yourself, you know, people like me, I hope, use other words and other terms. Like, I'm always floored. Even now, to this day, I can go somewhere and like something is rated as like, oh, this one's hot, or it's got four chilies or three chilies next to it. And because my palate has such a different spectrum for how to kind of classify spice, I'm often disappointed unless I'm in an ethnic restaurant if I see something, a dish as spicy, because I've found that unless it's from an you know, a non-Eurocentric country, it's never actually hot to me at all. Like, it never meets my definition of spicy, because my definition of spicy, like, I know some people where if you put Frank's Red Hot, it's too hot. Like, that's spicy. Whereas to me, that's not even a pepper. That's vinegar, right?
Totally know what you're saying.
It's always an interesting thing to me. And I think that that's why, you know, in talking and pivoting a little bit to like ushering a new subset, a new population, a new sector of folks drinking, it's going to be about like, look, everyone's not eating Dover sole and, you know, roasted quail or pheasant or anything like that. Like, people are having fried chicken or shrimps or crab cakes or stuff like that. So I think that there are people like you and like myself and like many of our other colleagues on the SOM TV network that are about going like, look, if you like this shit with potato chips, French onion dip and sour cream, go ahead and have that. And we can give you the science of why that makes sense that these wines pair well. But at the end of the day, if you like it, I love it. Whether or not I'll drink it is a different question. But if you like it, I love it. Like, I'd never argue with a person that a pairing doesn't work. Like, I will say I don't get the science of how that would work, but I haven't eaten every dish that you've eaten. I don't like tomato sandwiches or anything like that with soup. I like chicken noodle soup with peanut butter and jelly. Somehow, the sweet and the saltiness of those two things counter in the absolute best way. But if I tell somebody, listen, it is actually snowing in New York right now, get you just a regular old can of Campbell's chicken noodle soup and make yourself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and eat those two things together and tell me it's not amazing, someone is going to cancel their Somm TV subscription. Like, you know what? I thought you knew shit about wine, but that pairing tells me that you know nothing and I no longer
want
your
advice. Can I ask you this? Do you have a position on putting potato chips on your peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Are you pro or con?
I mean, scientifically, knowing the tongue and taste the way it does, that makes sense, right? It's so the saltiness, the same saltiness in the peanut butter as saltiness in the potato chips.
An extra crunch. It's just, and
yeah,
hear me
texturally
out.
Texturally, it's great.
Not even just
and
a, depending not even on just a regular potato chip, but like a Dorito. If we want to get pretty
super
basic.
Spice.
It's not bad.
I wish they had Doritos now because
I would
try that.
Can you tell I'm hungry?
No, but I'm like it's the same thing, right? It's why caviar works with a buckwheat pancake, chives, shallots, a tart-ass creme fraiche. That's the same reason that it works with French fries or potato chips, right? It's this very highly salted texture. But I think the more we open that space up, like, yes, listen, I just winked to Danielle a couple of weeks ago. I live for, like, extra pompous caviar service with Bellini's chives, boiled eggs, separated into eggs and white. I'm here for that. I am also here with caviar. My favorite thing is caviar. You get a thing of creme fraiche. You pour a cheap-ass packet of Lipton's French onion soup into that, and you eat potato chips, Lipton's onion soup, and caviar together. Blows your mind. Blows it. Completely. Now, is that a traditional pairing? Someone's gonna listen to this and go, ew, gross. I challenge you to try it and tell me you think it's gross, because I don't believe you'll think it's gross. And I think that the more, you know, there are voices like us present that are like, look, there's a right and, I mean, if you're testing someone, there has to be a right and wrong answer, right? And I think that's one of the major issues in the courts, but that's a whole other podcast that we have to explore in 2021. You know this.
Oh, yes.
But I think there needs to be a benchmark for testing, but I also think that that benchmark needs to be equitable for all the people that might take the test. Because if you are from white or black, if you're from Alabama, what are the odds that you've ever tasted like why something should work with Duck L'Orange or, you know, like who the fuck is eating this in Alabama? Are there snails farmed in Alabama? I'm sure you can get it. And there's no disrespect to the culinary thumbprint of the state of Alabama, which, by the way, if you're into food, it's probably one of the fastest rising food scenes, culinary scenes in the country, but whatever. But that person isn't going to be able to relate a pairing of, you know, escargot and a really rich Chardonnay, right? Because they've not had either of those things together. And so, you know, you are one of the voices that I love on social media. You're quite active. You're quite transparent about, you know, the organizations that you've studied with, the pride you take in the dedication, and the hard work that it took to earn the certifications that you had, but you've been quite critical of the court. And I mean, there's a large sector of the population that doesn't know where they fall on this. You know, there's people that they like and that they've admired and they've looked up to, and two of those people could be on totally different pages on where they fall in the court. And you have a unique perspective of, you know, an accepted reason of why there would be a level of commitment, and also for other reasons why you would be completely disgusted at many of the things that have happened. I want to know your opinion on if there is a way, and there are things being done, but if there is a way for the court to move forward, one or two things that must be at the forefront of how we move forward with the court.
I hope that there is a way for the Court of Master Sommeliers to move forward. I think as I said earlier today, like, you know, the wine industry has evolved, yet these organizations have not evolved, I think, at the same pace. And, you know, I've been talking to some folks who, you know, are the newly elected board of directors, and I've made my points pretty clear in some internal communications. But what I think needs to happen, and I haven't yet given up hope. I still think that the structure and sort of the path that certification through the court, I think that's very helpful and has been helpful to so many people in the industry. It's also been very hurtful to many people in the industry. I think there needs to be some cleaning of house. I think there are clearly, it's been very publicly shared, that there are some bad actors in this organization. And the ability to pass a test and know some stuff about wine, clearly, and I've said this for a long time before I passed the exam even, that the ability to pass a test does not mean you are kind, good, funny. You know, none of that is true. It means you passed a test. And there's some bad actors, and they need to be gone. I don't want to be associated with them. They've taken advantage of their position and their influence, and that's unacceptable. So I would like there to be a thorough cleaning of house. And it's interesting, you know, the organization is almost entirely male. There aren't that many women. I knew that before I ever pursued certification with the court, and it's very clear to me now. And it's not that all the men are being accused. You know, if it's 100%, right, not even 50% of the men, it's some bad actors. And there are plenty of good men in this organization, but there's enough people who have acted, you know, completely inappropriately and criminally and horribly and selfishly and callously to hurt people that they got to go.
Yeah.
I think a lot has been done internally. I think the communications from the organization to people pursuing certification and the public at large, I think that will likely improve with this new leadership. I trust in that. I really am hopeful about that. And with that, I think reckoning that just saying that the court is an examination body, that doesn't fly any longer. People's mm-hmm. identities are wrapped up in this organization. And I'm not just talking about master sommeliers. I'm talking about people who take pride in taking and passing the certified sommelier examination or the introductory sommelier examination or the advanced. It becomes part of people's identities and it matters very much to them. And so it's not just an examining organization. I think we need to define what it is. Is it a volunteer organization? Is it an academic credential? Is it a club? We need to figure that part out. And then everything about a code of conduct and ethics has to reflect that, because when you have a group of people and a professional organization that's so wrapped up in and all of the people who it's touched, good or bad or neutral, everything that organization does is impactful to those people. So yes, if it remains silent in the face of social and racial injustice, that's hurtful. That can't happen. If women are allowed to be assaulted and abused and raped and victimized, that's unacceptable. So I think the restructuring and the reframing and the communication about who we are and what we stand for and what we tolerate and what we don't, I think that needs to happen. And then also, I've been very clear about this because it's an incredibly important part of my story and my history, is that what happened in 2018 needs to be thoroughly investigated. And I'll never get over that. I have moved forward. But what happened was so horrible in that it was so unjust. And we were, you know, those who were affected were really not treated fairly. And these men, by the way, who are accused of criminal activities, they're being afforded opportunities that were never given to people who were never accused of any wrongdoing. So they're getting the benefit of a third-party investigation, and we'll see what comes of that. That never happened to anyone in 2018. And so I would like to see a thorough investigation and an exoneration of the people who did nothing wrong, because those are some people who are accomplished and kind and considerate and talented and diverse people from all over the industry, not just from the United States. And they deserve the platform and the microphone that they earned, and the court would be better and more diverse as a result. So those are the big things I think that are key priorities for me.
I love it. And that makes, you know, that when you try to address the core of the problem and not the symptoms, you get to real solutions, right? So something as simple as, you know, 2018, every one of those people deserve exoneration except for the ones that actually cheated. But there's also so much intertwined with that and privilege and stuff. Like, how many people had the money to actually prepare themselves again to take it? And how much is that a barrier to so many other people where, look, this was my one shot at it and I've been robbed of it. Like, I don't have the time, the money, or the resources to do this again. And so there's so much in that. And I think there is work to be done. Just from my own professional background, I don't think that replicating a broken system or structure is effective ever. And so if you want to enact new change, you really have to look at what the core problem is. And so I am you. I am cautiously optimistic about the potential for change, but I also know the benchmarks that I'm looking for, where if these core issues and core problems are not addressed, there will be no change.
Yeah.
So let's lighten up a bit, because what you and I mostly do together is drink bottles that we love and talk about it. So at this point in the show, you know, I always am fascinated by people like yourself with such vast knowledge. Like, one of the things I love about wine is that I'm never satisfied. I always want to try a new bottle, a new producer, a new grape, a new region. When you have the level of knowledge that you have, there's a part of me that thinks like, damn, do they run out of like new stuff to try? If I were to ask you what new region or new grape or new producer you've really been into, what would the answer be? What's new that you're into drinking right now that you think other people should try?
Ooh, that's a really good question. And I, oh man, my answer is going to sound so lame, because I actually have not been drinking a lot of wine. No, it's kind of lame, because I actually have not been drinking a lot of wine lately. I don't know
why. In this pandemic?
You know, I don't know what it is. Chicago's been such a mess, and, you know, our weather is really bad, and there's only a few limited places where people are even still able to accommodate outdoor dining. And so it's been, I think it's part of the isolation, that it's just, for me, wine is so much of a shared and social thing that, like, not like I can't just pop open a bottle and just drink it by myself. Like, obviously can totally do that. But, and so more often than not, I've just been like making an cocktail, like one single drink, and just like kind of sipping on that. But I really haven't been drinking a lot of wine, but I'm a generalist, and I just love sort of what like comes across my path.
Mm.
I mean, obviously the last wine I drank was, you know, some German wines with you.
Some German stuff.
Right? And so like since then, I don't actually think I've had a sip of wine. I'm so embarrassed of myself right now. I'm like letting down our profession. I don't know.
What is going on, girl?
Can I tell you that then the shame is that, like, I was telling Nadine, like, you know, what I've been drinking more, like I was drinking a lot of cocktails, and I have recently discovered, I'm very late to the party, a very simple cocktail that apparently people have loved for a long time, but a dirty martini, I've never been
a fan.
And I, you know, like, so laws have changed, and restaurants all over the country are pivoting to go options and delivery options. And restaurants in Chicago are able to offer, you know, individual pre-made cocktails to go, or cocktail kits. And so I got myself a cocktail kit, and it came with all the fixings. It was so cute and so styled up. And it's, you know, it's a bottle of vodka and some olive brine and some olives. And I got to use my fancy picks that never get used, my fancy little metal picks. And
to get all of your olives?
I know. And I was like, look at me. I was like, it's an appetizer and a cocktail all in one.
Well, now we've got to ask, when it comes to your martinis, are you a gin girl, a vodka girl, or a Vesper girl?
Well, I am a gin lover. And I... vodka for the dirty martini, but if it's, I was also making like 50-50 martinis, you know, with just like equal parts gin and vermouth.
My favorite kind.
Yeah, it's really, so I was making like gin martinis with like Dolin Blanc vermouth or the dry vermouth, and those I really like. So I think it depends on the style of martini. But yeah, I know I really haven't been drinking a whole lot of wine. I have no excuse. I don't know what my problem is. I think I just, maybe I've just been in a phase. I'm sorry. That's not a very helpful answer.
What? Of all the times, you might be the only person I know whose consumption of wine has decreased, but it's fine. All right. So for the purposes of this, though, let's go back. Let's go back to a pre-COVID time. I know there's got to be a great, a producer, a region, a style, something that you were really into, stoked to share with other people, that you think they should be exploring. What would that have been pre-COVID?
Oh, that's a good question.
I pride myself on good questions.
I know. It's a really good question. All right. So here's a little story, and I think it kind of illustrates something that could be exciting. A few years ago, I went to Bordeaux. Bordeaux is like one of the most like quote-unquote classic areas. They've been making wine for hundreds of years. It's available all over the world. It's something that like even a novice individual in the world of wine has heard of Bordeaux, right? And when I was there, you know, you taste these wines all day, and it's not necessarily what you want to drink at night. You just need a change up of your palate. And so this is in the city of Bordeaux proper, and I was kind of wandering about with the friends that I was with on the trip, and we found a bar, a little wine bar, and it was an all Corsican wine bar. And I was like, hot damn, what are the chances that in Bordeaux, in like Cabernet Sauvignon Central, there's going to be an all Corsican wine bar? And it was so fantastic. I mean, the wines were crazy, and I didn't even know what most of them were, but I would like look at the label and I would look at the appellation. And I'd be like, this is theory coming alive. And so something like that, where you've maybe read about it or heard about it, but you've never actually tasted it before, I think that's a broad category. But sort of like with the German wines, like trying that German Meunier, like that Schwarzriesling, like I've only ever read about it. I've never had an example. So I think on a general level, something that is so off the beaten path that maybe from a theoretical standpoint, you know this grape or the style of wine is produced, but it's just not commercially very present. Mm-hmm. I think I would be super into that because it's like, wow, all right. I can, you know, on my list of like all the wines to try, I can like check that off. I've had this new experience. And I think that helps kind of your palate continue to grow and evolve. So yeah.
So Corsican wines. Gosh, I am super excited about Corsican wines. I think they're absolutely delicious.
Right.
Before shutdown, I had a really great one at Niche Niche in New York, and it was delicious. Okay, so we are at the point in our podcast where we tell everyone where they can follow you. But before that, right now, wherever you're listening to this, go to your search bar, type in Reading and Drinking, and subscribe to that podcast. Jill's podcast is amazing. If you're like me, when you really started to dive into wine, you bought every book on wine that you can find, some because they were gorgeous, others because you just thought like you wanted to absorb every ounce of information that you could. And a lot of them really weren't helpful at all. So Jill does an amazing job letting you know like which one of these books are actually worth getting and what you'll get out of them. Because I have learned that some books, maybe I didn't get as much from it because I was looking for the wrong thing. And Jill's podcast is amazing. So the most shameless plug ever. It's not a paid advertisement. It is a podcast that I listen to and love. So make sure that you subscribe to Reading and Drinking. And now, Jill, please tell everyone where they can follow you on social media.
I am on most of the social media platforms. I'm probably most active on Instagram, and Instagram and Twitter, it's just the same. It's just my name, Jill Zamorski. I am less active on Twitter unless it's liking dog pictures or maybe retweeting liberal political, you know, pundits. But on Instagram, you'll probably see a combination of food, wine, occasional pictures of my dog, and random Chicago scenes. But I'm most active on Instagram. I really am not too active on Facebook at all. But Instagram and Twitter are my preferred. I have yet to do the Snapchat or the TikTok because I just can only handle so many things.
I want to thank you so much, Jill, for being with me today. I cannot think of a better guest and conversation for people to listen to close out their year in wine. I hope that what they've taken away from this is like, listen, drink what you like, drink what is in your price point, drink around the world and enjoy it. There are many, many factual points of wine, but wine is absolutely foremost fun and communal and then factual. Guys, thank you so much for listening, and I cannot wait to be back. January 14th, we will be back with new guests and more amazing conversations. I am wishing you all during these holiday seasons, no matter what holiday you're celebrating, the absolute best. Drink something well, socially distance safely, connect with your friends and family, and we'll be back.